Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. Pope Benedict XVI has often highlighted the plight of the people of Darfur. The last time he did so was on Friday while receiving in audience the Sudanese ambassador to the Holy See, Hamad Hamed Al-Fiki. On this occasion, he insisted it was not too late for the country to find a solution to the conflict through dialogue and cooperation. In this murderous conflict, he pressed, which hits civilian populations first and foremost, everyone knows that no viable solution for a peace based on justice can be brought about through the force of arms. To backtrack for a moment, as you may recall, this ethnic and political conflict in Western Sudan flared up in 2003. When rebels took up arms, saying the government was neglecting the region. Khartoum is accused of using Arab militias known as Janjaweed to crush the revolt. A charge it denies. While human rights groups accuse the Janjaweed of killing civilians, looting and burning villages, and using rape as part of a terror campaign. This conflict has also triggered the world's biggest relief operation, with aid workers helping over 2 million people who have been forced to flee their homes. Tony Vazello works for the Catholic Aid and Development Agency, CATHOD, in the United Kingdom, and has just returned from a visit to Darfur, where he toured some of the camps housing the displaced people to see firsthand their desperate plight. He spoke to my colleague Susie Hodges about his impressions.
My first impression was that it was worse than I expected. I had seen photographs and DVDs of the conditions in the camps, but until you actually arrive at the camps and walk in the camps and experience the dust, the dryness, the heat, the huge vastness of the camps and the appalling conditions that people live in, then you will really be taken aback, and that I was taken aback at the sheer scale of it and the sheer awfulness of it all.
You mentioned the appalling conditions. Can you give us a couple of concrete examples of the things that most struck you?
Well, the first things that hit you when you get into the camp, apart from the children that run up to greet you, as inevitably all children do, are the abodes that people live in. And I can't call them houses, although they call them houses themselves. I mean, they are shacks, huts, tents. They're made of plastic sheeting or any other kind of material that people can get to build the places where they live. They've been there for 3 or 4 years, so you can imagine that the weather hasn't been kind to them, and any gaps that appear in them are plugged up by pieces of cardboard, sackcloth, discarded food sacks. But what is absolutely gobsmacking, if I can use that term, is that if you stand in the middle of it, as I did, and just turn around you can see these shacks, huts, shelters, as far as the eye can see. And people have lived there for 3 or 4 years, and they are really small. They sleep on the dusty ground. It's not a life for any human being, and no one should be asked to live in those conditions.
What kind of numbers are there in some of these camps that you visited?
They vary in number. In one camp that we visited, the Derej camp, there were 32,000 people living there. In some other camps, the numbers are much higher. They can be as high as 100,000 people living in a camp. So that creates an awful lot of problems. And one of the things that CAFOD and other agencies are doing is to bring humanitarian aid to people in the camps, and also to provide trauma counseling for people who have experienced the horrific experiences that they have. Because when some of them arrive there, particularly the women, They are traumatized. So it's important for that to give them one-to-one counseling so that they can come to terms with what's happened to them and also to rebuild their lives.
You talked there about the trauma, particularly of the women. There have been persistent allegations that there's widespread use of rape as a weapon of war. Did you hear of any direct evidence of this? I mean, or did you get to speak to some women who've been victims of such attacks?
I spoke mainly to the women in the camps. They all told me the same story, that they were living happily in their villages, and then what they termed as men on horses raided their villages, charged into their villages, killed people, burned their homes and looted. And they all tell me the same story, that they all fled with just the clothes that they were wearing and had to walk sometimes 2-3 days to get to the nearest place of safety. Some people, some of the women say that in the camps, they are virtually forced to remain in the camps because when they go out to collect firewood, they are assaulted and attacked by local tribesmen. No one actually came out and said that they were raped because that's obviously a very sensitive issue for them. But certainly we understand that some women have been assaulted, some women have been attacked and raped. The women go out to get the firewood during the day because if the men venture out, they will be killed. That I was told quite directly by the women in the camps.
How would you describe then the morale of these displaced people? You say some of them have been living in these camps for up to 3 years in these appalling conditions.
It depends. Some of them retain the hope of going back. Some of them retain hope generally. Some of them are despondent, believing that there will never be a peace which will enable them to go back. There are definite tensions in the camp. People are concerned. A recent escalation in the fighting has meant that an additional 300,000 people have now moved to the camps. In one camp alone, 5,000 additional displaced persons arrived in the last 6 months. Now, that places a great strain on the resources within the camp. So for the first time, for example, in the Derej camp, they have to share food among a greater number of people. So consequently, there's a food shortage. And that creates tension. The young men in the camps are also beginning to feel a bit restless because they are virtually confined to the camps in a prison without walls, if you like.
But when you talk to the people, do they appear to be very frightened of these attacks, these alleged attacks by the Janjaweed? I mean, is there a lot of fear?
They would like to go home. I mean, no one wants to remain in the camps. I mean, the conditions in the camps are not good. One woman told me, you know, my life here is very different from the life I had before. So, yes, people want to go back. One sheikh that we spoke to had tried to go back, and he took some of his tribesmen back with him to his village. He was chased away, and all their belongings were stolen. Another woman I spoke to, I asked her if she'd go back, and her reply was quite emphatic. And she said, actually, no, no, no. If I go back, I will be killed. So they're not going to go back until they can be sure that there is a lasting and permanent peace, and then they will return. They do want to go back, but they're too frightened to go back.
Do you have any other anecdotes about conversations with the displaced people? You know, some sort of other remarks that have particularly stuck in your mind?
Well, I think what stuck in my mind from one woman, her name was Amina, and she, like the others, had fled in terror from her village. She walked 1.5 days to the nearest camp with one child trapped on her back and the others holding her hands. She arrived traumatized. She arrived frightened. She was helped in the camps. They gave her plastic sheeting for which to build a house. They took her in, provided her with food and shelter and so forth. And she'd been through the whole experience of that. She'd been through the trauma counseling. But I asked her, you've been through all this. You live in this camp. What message can you give to the people back home? And she said that she was grateful for the support that she had received. And she was grateful, too, for people standing with her, by her side, but she said that the need that they have in the camps is still great, and asks for our further support, not just in the donations that we can give, which help them to remain alive, but also in what efforts we can do to build a lasting peace, which is really the answer to this problem. Because until we get a lasting peace, the situation is going to remain the same.
In fact, the displaced people disappointed that the international community hasn't been able to put more pressure perhaps on the Sudanese government to try to arrive at a lasting peace.
I don't think that a lot of them understand the international implications. They see it very locally, the problems that they have in Darfur. They don't necessarily appreciate the international implications, at least some of them. Others do. And the message that they tell us is that we need peace. So what we have to do as CAFOD and other agencies is to urge the international community to stir itself into action. Now, there was a peace agreement last year of sorts, but it didn't include all the warring factions. The largest of the rebel groups weren't included in the peace deal. So they're still going around fighting and killing and looting. So until the international community brings all the parties together to negotiate an inclusive peace, the situation in Darfur will remain as it is. It is, I think, incumbent upon the UN, the US, the UK, and the other European countries to do what they can to bring about that peace. They have to remember that 2 million people are displaced and living in camps. They have to remember that 4.5 million people are in need of humanitarian aid. That's a massive, massive scale. So we need to bring peace to that part of the world, to Darfur, for people to be able to return to their homes and to resume their lives.
You've been listening to Tony Vazello, who works for the Catholic Aid and Development Agency, CAFOD, in the United Kingdom, speaking there to my colleague Susie Hodges. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.